Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from our offices overlooking San Francisco's financial district. I am Tony Remby, president-elect of the club, and your chair today. Before going further, I also want to welcome the listeners of KMZT-FM in Los Angeles, one of our more than 225 radio stations nationwide, carrying America's longest-running radio program. We invite all our listeners here and on radio to visit us on the Internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now for today's speaker. Orville Schell graduated magna cum laude from Harvard University in Far Eastern History, did his MA and PhD work at the University of California, Berkeley, in Chinese history, and is among America's most highly regarded China scholars. His newest book in this area is Virtual Tibet, which will be in stores in June and is published by Henry Holt and Company. He is currently professor and dean of the University of California, Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. At Berkeley, Dean Schell has worked hard to establish the graduate work as a kind of working center where aspiring writers and journalists collaborate with accomplished and seasoned professionals. And for many students, there is no better model than Orville, who has worked at the highest levels of journalism. He is a longtime contributor to The New Yorker and has written for The Atlantic, The New York Times Magazine, The Nation, New York Review of Books, and numerous other periodicals. His many books on China include Mandate of Heaven, Discos and Democracy, and The China Reader. He has appeared as a television commentator on NBC, CBS, ABC, and PBS. Virtual Tibet, his new book, is subtitled Searching for Shangri-La, From the Himalayas to Hollywood. In the book, he examines the realities of this mysterious place, controlled for now and for the foreseeable future by China, and contrasts these realities with the highly romanticized visions provided in literature and on film. Please join me in welcoming Dean Orville Schell, author of Virtual Tibet.
Well, thank you. 95 years ago, after the Young Husband Expedition, which was a British military expedition that battled its way from India to Lhasa and represented the first time that Westerners had actually succeeded in penetrating the mysterium of that very carefully guarded city. One of the men on that expedition, L. Austin Waddell, wrote the following. He wrote, "Wreathed in the romance of centuries, Lhasa, the secret citadel of the undying Grand Lama, has stood shrouded in impenetrable mystery on the roof of the world, alluring yet defying our most adventuresome travelers to enter her closed gates. With all the fascination of an unsolved enigma, this mysterious city has held the imagination captive as one of the last secret places on earth." Now, admittedly, this was written almost a century ago, but in a certain very important way, that sentiment that Tibet was somehow ineffable, unknowable, mysterious, spiritually dense, and separate from the rest of the hurly-burly of the world outside, has remained with us as a kind of a DNA that keeps expressing itself over and over and again, each generation henceforth. And you may wonder, why is this of any consequence? Why do we care? Why has the notion of Tibet as being somehow mysterious and somehow other, why does that have any consequence to what we do today? And does it, in fact, have any implications for the way the great tragedy of Tibet's modern future plays itself out? I think the answer to that question is that it does. And I want to share some thoughts with you today about how that is the case and why this exceedingly intractable problem of Tibet and China is rendered all the more unresolvable by the kinds of baggage that each side, whether it's China or whether it's the West, brings to this puzzle of Tibet, the West, and China. Because indeed, as a policy question, it is a kind of curious triangle. It is a triangle that has Tibet in the center, or at least on one important leg of the triangle, but on the two other sides, the West and China, there are two extremely different opposing visions of what this land is all about. So when we think of Tibet, and when we think of the Tibet problem and the tragedy of Tibet, we are also bringing to it several centuries of our own accrual of images. Tibet, as I have suggested in this new book of mine, is as much for us in the West a virtual form as it is an actual form. It is a real place, but it also is a place that we have chosen to imagine and to imbue with significance, a significance that grows as much out of our own yearning to believe that there is such a place as the place we imagine. And ironically, China does the same thing, but in a very different way. And it is these two colliding fantasies, one could say, based in many respects on a reality, that collide and make this problem of Tibet so difficult to unravel and finally to solve. Now, Tibet, in a way which I think no other geographic place on the world has become a kind of a magnet for what we want to make of it. L. Austin Waddell, in this quote that I've just quoted, was a doctor. He was also the cultural attaché on this expedition that Sir Francis Younghusband led in 1904 that finally battered their way into Lhasa. And what was very curious about that expedition was that all the way as they were fighting to Lhasa, and before they even left India to go to Lhasa, there was this incredible sense of expectation that once they could get to this magical place, what they called the holy city, the forbidden city, because indeed nobody had been to, no Westerner that is, had been to Lhasa for 100 years before that. And the only other Westerner who'd actually made it there in the last, or at least Englishman, was a very curious Cantabrigian who in 1811 had managed to secretly sneak himself in with a caravan. But each time someone got to Lhasa, there was a kind of a strange process of disappointment that set in, as if the city, the mystery of Lhasa once attained, wasn't half as exciting as the mystery of Lhasa and Tibet unattained. And in fact, there are many allusions in the early writings about people who tried to get to Tibet and get to Lhasa of Tibet almost like a beautiful woman who was unapproachable, who could not be conquered, and whose very unconquerability was what made her, or in this case, the city, so persuasive. Now, if you actually think about it, you think about Tibet, there's probably no place in the world that's more unlikely for to become the receptor site of a fantasy. After all, when you look at Western fantasies, we certainly have one in relation to the South Seas. Swaying palm trees, azure lagoons, hula girls, soft music, warm water. This is plausible. This we can understand. It's the good life. But now turn to Tibet for a minute, and what have you? You have cold. You have barrenness. You have exceedingly bad food. Remember that Tibetan life centers around the lowly yak, and that means raw yak meat. At the high end of the food chain would be yak yogurt. There would be other various foods derived from the yak, and it pretty much ends there and begins there. The only roughage that Tibetans are known to eat were thistles, not exactly a delectable thought for those of you schooled in Nouvelle Cuisine in Northern California. There were very few amenities in Tibet, no trees to speak of on the Tibetan plateau, an extremely harsh life, mostly nomadic, a land that was run pretty much by the theocracy, the only civilized outposts in this whole land, which was larger than Western Europe, were monasteries where young Tibetan boys could learn to read as part of the monastic tradition. Again, it was a very stern life and a very hard life. Not exactly the stuff from which one would imagine fantasies of any kind, particularly Western fantasies, might be born. And yet, Tibet did serve as this magical place. I remember very clearly as a teenage boy in 1953, when I was 13 years old, when Heinrich Harrer's book, 7 Years in Tibet, came out. And here was this amazing story about this Austrian mountain climber, many of you may have seen the film, who escaped from a British prisoner of war camp in India, climbed across the Himalayas, almost 2 years across the Changhang Plateau of Tibet, enduring incredibly ardent and arduous and painful months out in the middle of nowhere to arrive in Lhasa to become the tutor of the Dalai Lama. It was a kind of a dream come true. And for many, including myself, this did spark a fascination in this strange land. It was a fascination that I think was born for me by the sheer notion of the unabsorbability of Tibet, the fact that it did not want to be like us. It did not want to even join the world outside. And this represented not just a fantasy growing out of one book, but there were several hundred years of accrued wisdom, if you will, of accrued experience, mythology, and imagination that went into making that book so redolent of this place that many people would have given anything to have a go at getting there. Now, all of this began back, actually, several hundred years ago in the 1700s, 1600s, when the first Capuchin and Jesuit missionaries landed in Lhasa seeking to save souls. They were very practical people. They didn't romanticize Tibet. They wanted to win Tibet and Tibetans over to Jesus. And they had a tough row to hoe. And they spent several decades there, and the number of souls that they harvested for Jesus, I think you could have counted on two hands. And the experience basically ended. But it was interesting because it was a time where Tibet and Lhasa, the theocracy in Lhasa, accepted outsiders into its midst. It didn't repel them as it did later. And what these experiences did was to lay down a corpus of work and descriptions about this strange land, this Buddhist theocracy that seemed so far away from the world as it went into the Industrial Revolution. And these works came to light again in the 19th century, and they became part of this gathering corpus of work that fed into the mythology of Tibet as a land apart. But what was interesting was that the missionaries didn't really care about Buddhism. They cared about Catholicism. They didn't care about Tibet as a land of spiritual meaning that they could absorb. They wanted Tibet to absorb what they had to offer, their evangelism. Now, they were followed by a series of British, from the British East India Company, who were also interested not in Tibet as anything of spirit, as anything of mystery, but they were practically looking for a trade route to China. They heaved to and couldn't get to Lhasa. They got stuck halfway there in another monastery in Shigatse called Tashi Lumpo, where the Panchen Lama held court. And the fact that they couldn't get to Lhasa tended just to augment this sense that there must be something there. It's a very odd Western affectation that we want to go most where we aren't wanted. Not a Tibetan affectation. Tibetans didn't want to go anywhere. They were happy to stay where they were. And there was something about that contentment with where they were, as difficult a land as it was and as arduous a life as it was, which fascinated us in the West and made us think there must be something there. And it fed this fever, which also tended to have a confluence with the age of exploration that began to besiege the 19th century, where every out-of-the-way place in the globe had a fascination, particularly for the British, who were exploring the headwaters of the Nile, wanted to get to Mecca. Sir Francis Burton, in the middle of the century, sneaked into Mecca. People were trying to get to the North Pole, the South Pole, go up the Amazon. There was something about this Promethean drive to conquer the world, to colonialize the world, to discover the world. And Tibet was, as described by these explorers, a tantalizing blank place on the map. So that, too, tended to imbue this land with enormous significance, an enormous set of imperatives that drove the West to somehow want to conquer that one last unconquerable unknown place. Well, in the 19th century, another interesting thing happened to imbue Tibet with a new dimension of its mythology, and that was the imputation to this land that it was spiritually more evolved than the rest of the world. Now, remember, the rest of the world is engaged now in the Industrial Revolution. There's dyspepsia, a malaise about the industrial life. The scientific world is overturning the church, overturning the ability of Westerners to believe. And so it was very convenient to find Tibet, a place to which we could export our yearning to believe. And we could believe that they believed. Those monks, all those lovely Buddhists up there, believed in a way that we couldn't believe. And we were enchanted by the notion that they still believed in divination, in magic, that they had this capacity, this almost guileless, childlike capacity to put away their rationalism. This, too, impressed us as something for which we yearned, for something which we had lost. And so the theosophists, which still exist today, arose out of this notion that India and Tibet had a higher spiritual content than the West did. Lord Curzon, who at the time of the Young Husband Expedition was the Governor General of India, put it this way. I want to just quote for you what he had to say about, you know, the East, the mysterious East. It's a little less mysterious now, and yet the residue of that still carries forward in ways which I think are quite subliminal. He said, "The East is a temple where the supplicant adores but never catches sight of the object of his devotion. It is a journey, the goal of which is always in sight but never attained. In the heart of Asia, there lasts to this day one mystery which the 19th century has left to the 20th to explore, the Tibetan Oracle of Lhasa." Well, you can see the world as it was becoming known left those of us who were traveling around it and leaves those of us who continue to travel with a kind of a yearning to know that there was some place apart. The theosophists believed that Tibet was on some mysterious spiritual axis that connected Tibet and Egypt and Mesopotamia. There were these Mahatmas, these men of great learning. Remember Mahatma Gandhi, Madame Blavatsky, the inimitable Madame Blavatsky, all 350 pounds of her, ended up in India and alleged to have lived in Tibet among these Mahatmas and wrote many, many, many long-winded, inscrutable books. Albert Einstein kept one on his bedside table about the ways in which Tibet embodied and captured the spiritual density and depth of life that had eluded us in the West. So this, too, was a very powerful dimension in the mythology of Tibet. And then something curious happened. In the early 20th century, you will recall that several centuries ago, mountains were, for most people, places to be avoided. They were high, cold, miserable, threatening, bad weather, and people had no love for mountains. Mountains were things you walked around. You didn't walk up. But after the turn of the century, again, as a result of sort of post-industrial malaise and also the sudden fascination that the West felt for landscape, mountains became imbued with a sense of majesty. Not only that, they began to be viewed as holy sites. It's no accident but that both Tibetan Buddhists and the Hindus imagine that all of the gods came from the mountains of Tibet. Well, Westerners began to think, too, that mountains somehow had a stern, sovereign, and inviting majesty, and that Promethean energy that had led the West into exploration now began to provoke Westerners to want to climb these mountains. And the Alps became the object of our desire. And Westerners started trying to go up these mountains, not around them. And they began to write of these mountains as places almost as if they were cathedrals. John Muir came to California, went to Yosemite in the Sierras, and wrote almost as if he was having a religiously ecstatic experience of being among the mountains. Now, there was one problem for the British. They had no mountains. And yet, they had the Indian Raj. They had India. And what was to the north of India the tallest mountains in the world? Mount Everest. And so India became a stepping off point for English fantasies. They couldn't go to Tibet. Tibet didn't want them. So what did they do? The great trigonometrical survey, which sought to map all of India and then turn to Tibet, hired a series of so-called natives, Indians, who they could dress up and treat and teach to survey Tibet, and they sent them in secretly with compasses in their walking sticks, with all sorts of apparatus to map Tibet and to fill in that mysterious white blankness on the map. And then mountain climbers followed. And if you read the works of George Lee Mallory, who climbed Everest possibly the first time in the 20s, we don't know, his body was just found, his writings read like religious texts about the incredible ecstatic experience of seeing Everest emerge from the clouds, of being on this pure, stern, godlike mountain that was closer to heaven than anything on earth. And when Mallory died and there was a religious service for him back in England in Westminster Cathedral, the bishop who read the eulogy spoke of Mallory's experience of climbing mountains, not as just crude climbing, but as a religious ascent, a kind of an ascent into godliness. Well, this did a tremendous amount to imbue Tibet with a whole other dimension of spirituality. Not only was Buddhism viewed to be a higher form of spiritualism, because after all, it didn't seek to make Buicks, it sought to generate good karma, enlightenment, whereas we were out there grinding out industrial gross national product. We wanted to know some place existed that didn't have such a fallen state of grace. And in the 1930s, a book came out which had a tremendously powerful impact on the way we view Tibet. It was Lost Horizon, 1933. It was the first paperback. 1937, Frank Capra did the movie. And thus came into popular culture, into the lexicon of the West, one of the most powerful utopian metaphors of the century, Shangri-La. Shangri-La was a place where if you could attain it, you didn't grow old, you didn't get sick, where this wonderful old Lama, he was called a Lama, but he was from Belgium. They played Rameau on the harpsichord. They read Buddhist texts. It was, you know, Oriental, but not too. It was, you know, a land of enormous, it was paradise. And where was it? It was in the Himalayas, a mysterious place. And who could not be beguiled by such an image? With Europe perched on the edge of the Holocaust in World War II, civilization such as it was, posed on the abyss of utter implosion and the nightmare that was to be brought both to Asia and to Europe by the Japanese, Germans, and Italians, the Axis powers, it was a very tempting mythology to heap on to the already overburdened Tibet. So I think one would have to say that the history of the mythology of Tibet is a land of enormous significance and import. If you could only get there, life would be better. Somehow you would wake up and be enlightened. And indeed, when Sir Francis Younghusband was about to leave Lhasa in 1904 after marching to that holy city and killing thousands of Tibetans, he went out with a Buddha that had been given to him by a monk who had negotiated the the treaty that England had signed with the Tibetans. And he rode off into the mountains, and he had this amazingly mystical, cathartic experience, which he writes about in his book, where he felt at one with God, at one with humanity. I mean, it was, you know, it was the quintessential moment of revelation. This stiff upper lip Brit who had, you know, was not just a spiritualist, although he was that too. He was also a conqueror. And he went out, and Tibet undid him. Tibet gave him revelation. The scales fell from his eyes. Henceforth, he turned into a very strange man and had set up a series of very curious organizations that believed in the brotherhood of all men, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, we come to a curious denouement in the 50s when the mysterium of Tibet was punctured by something infinitely more potent than a few Western explorers. It was punctured by the Chinese Communist Party and the People's Liberation Army. Mao Zedong decided that he was going to put the old Chinese empire back together again. China was tired of being kicked around. And he sent, first of all, he asked a man who would become his minister of defense, Peng Dehuai, to go and lead an occupation force. Peng refused, so he turned to Deng Xiaoping, who was the general in charge of the Southwest Military Command on the edge of Tibet. Chinese marched into Tibet. It's a long story. They occupied it. The Dalai Lama fled 10 years ago in 1959. But without going into the whole history of what happened, suffice it to say that for those of us in the West, what felt like was happening was we were having our dreams occupied by an unwelcomed army. We were being deprived of our ability to believe in this place that was a land apart. Inviolable, sensible, humane, religious, beautiful, stern, pure, all of these things were somehow suddenly sullied by China's occupation. We resented it without even quite knowing what was going on. And what happened, and why I decided that I ought to write a book about it, was that denied Tibet as it had been, as a place that was real, a geographic place, a place that was miraculous in many ways, but also a place filled with our projections, denied this place that had meant so much to the West, and most of us had never gotten there. What did we do? Well, we did what we've often done in the 20th century. We turned to Hollywood to recreate it for us. And it was no accident that in the last few years, a spate of films from Hollywood have come out about Tibet. One of them was about 7 years in Tibet, starring none other than Brad Pitt. The other was Kundun, many of you, I'm sure, saw it, by Martin Scorsese, about the Dalai Lama's life. Now, I went down to Argentina to watch them rebuild Lhasa in the Argentine Andes because I wanted to see what this was, this recreation of this lost world was all about. And it was very interesting. An incredible experience to arrive in Ushuaia, Argentina, on the Chilean border, drive out into the desert, and find the sacred Jokhang, the most sacred place in all of Lhasa in Tibet, recreated in a way so faithful that you actually felt you were right in Tibet. And they flew in 150 Tibetans, many of them practicing monks, reincarnate lamas, to act in the film because they wanted the film to be real. Well, the monks who hadn't been home to Tibet since 1959 arrived in front of the Jokhang, and many of them fell down in a prostration before it and wept, and then launched a ceremony to initiate this set. They were home. There was only one problem. They were in Argentina. And what it suggested to me, and these were really wonderful people, people who'd undergone an enormous tribulation. And it is it is utterly true that what Tibet has undergone is a great tragedy. But what it suggested as I watched this drama of this recreation of this old world that had meant so much to us being recreated was that in a certain way, the Tibetans who were in exile from their land had also fallen under the sway of our own Western romanticization of their land. Now, if you look on the other side of this mythology, this myth-making process, we find China And what do we find there? Well, we find the absolute antithesis of this sort of rouged up version of Tibet as the land of spirit, of cuddly, nice people who have, you know, compassion and feel nothing but nonviolence towards all living creatures. Much of it true, I might add. But what you find in China is a vision of Tibet that Mao Zedong conjured up to begin with, of a land that was feudal, backward, superstitious, exploitative, and repressive. A land where the monasteries and the theocracy that ran them exploited the serfs and the land all around them, kept these people in enslavement. You find a mythology of a land where the aristocrats, who also kept massive estates and had serfs to run them, were also part of an exploiting class. Yes, they got to wear funny hats. Yes, they had an elaborate and beautiful set of ceremonies. Yes, Tibetan Buddhism was a kind of a perfection of spiritualism and ritual. But in the Chinese version of things, it was also a formula for rampant exploitation, injustice. When Mao looked up to Tibet, he didn't see peace and tranquility in Shangri-La. What he saw was inequity, injustice, and exploitation, and he sent Deng Xiaoping up there to do something about it. And in due course, they did a great deal about it. They destroyed almost every monastery in Tibet during the Cultural Revolution. Now, in all fairness, one must say they destroyed almost every monastery in China as well. So there was a certain equity to the savagery. But nonetheless, the Tibetans didn't ask to be liberated by Mao Zedong. And what is striking is that his form of liberation was so different from the Buddhist form of liberation. The Chinese communist version of liberation was out there. Rearrange the furniture, overturn classes, get rid of the landlords, give land to the peasantry, and then collectivize it. In other words, it was an exterior kind of revolution, whereas the most elemental aspect of Tibetan Buddhism is leave the world as it is. It's just an illusion. Rearrange what's in your head. Enlightenment comes about through meditation and spiritual practice. It doesn't come about through revolution. Well, you can imagine these two worlds sailed over each other with very little in common. And it was, I think, a dimension, this asymmetry, that added enormously to the tragedy of what happened, because there was no way really to communicate. So China felt utterly righteous in what it did to Tibet. The West felt it had its dream invaded, felt its society that it had venerated and revered because it was precisely because it was old-fashioned, it was traditional, it wasn't materialistic, scientific, rationalistic. Suddenly you had the People's Liberation Army up there overturning it. It was like having a nightmare. And it was no small wonder that when Hollywood turned to Tibet, they did not turn to Tibet after 1959. They tried to recreate the old Tibet. That was the Tibet in our heads. That was the Tibet in my head from reading Heinrich Harrer's 7 Years in Tibet. And it is the Tibet which I think in many ways continues on and helps evoke much of our sympathy, and much of our imagination is filled with that old Tibet. But if you go there today, you will be shocked by what you find. A rather ugly Chinese city. Yes, with a potala sitting up on Red Hill, but otherwise a city that's not very prepossessing. Now, why does any of this matter? And why do we care? And why have I wasted a half an hour of your time describing a perhaps interesting but possibly epiphenomenal analysis of how each side looks at Tibet? I might add the Nazis had their version of Tibet. Turned out Heinrich Harrer was a Nazi. Their version of Tibet was it was the land from which the Aryan race had sprung when the lost continent of Atlantis sunk. And they sent many expeditions to Tibet to measure people's skulls and do all their, you know, rather bizarre, ethnographic research. So it tended to be a place where everybody wanted to have a projection. Now, I think it's important that we take a little time to try to unravel the meaning of this place, precisely because it is an incredible tragedy. And Tibet is a place at once of no consequence and of great consequence. It's of consequence because the world seems to care about it. It's of consequence because the Chinese are so bedeviled by it. When I was in China with President Clinton, I sat literally 10 feet away from Jiang Zemin as he and Clinton began to banter. Suddenly, Jiang Zemin tried to end the conversation. And Clinton, in his boyish way, said, no, this is too much fun. I have a few more things I'd like to raise. And he raised the question of Tibet. And he began to say, you know, I've met the Dalai Lama, President Jiang, and I think if you met him, you'd probably like him. He's a great guy. Well, Jiang Zemin didn't quite know what to say to that. But what he did say was he expressed incredulity that people steeped in reason and living in the West might venerate what he called Lamaism. It's a good question. From his perspective, it was a bit unknowable. It seems to me that why it's important to unravel some of this mythology is because somehow this has to be resolved. And China is very militant about it. Militant precisely because the West cares about it so much. And precisely because China feels it's their business, it's an internal matter, Tibet is part of China, end of story, get out of our dream, West. At the same time, of course, we would like the Chinese to get out of our dream. But nobody seems to be vacating anybody's dream. And China feels very beset upon by the Dalai Lama girdling the globe, going to Hollywood, going to New York, appearing on television, and everybody so sympathetic. And indeed, he's an incredibly sympathetic man. And in fact, I would say, if I was going to have an adversary, I can't imagine a more workable adversary than the Dalai Lama. And it is a great shame that China can't view him as somebody with whom they could work. Instead, they see him as a splittist, a political insect, and various other insulting names. But what lies, I think, in some measure at least behind this terrible abyss that exists between China and Tibet are these competing and contending mythologies. And one exacerbates the other, and one tends to be as totalistic as the other. And none of this is to say that what China did in Tibet is excusable. It isn't. And none of it is to say that China's vision of Tibet is justifiable. In many ways, it isn't. It's only to say that when you have a subject that's so deeply fraught with so much added baggage and so many imagined traits imputed to it, it becomes very hard to sort out real interest. It becomes very hard to look at it for what it really is. And it becomes very hard to detach all of the emotional baggage that weigh it down and make it all the more sensitive to deal with. So finally, I think it's more than just sort of idle academic interest to try to parse through these various images of this curious land that has been so persuasive to us that we have invested so much interest and fascination into it. And it's worth remembering that seen from the Chinese perspective, there is a very equal and opposite kind of a mythology. And that in a certain sense, wherever you want to lay the blame, each side is locked into a version of a place that actually is only a partial description of what it really is. Finally, I think the tragedy of Tibet, as much as anything, is that the Tibetans who live in Tibet are largely silent. They cannot speak. And we really don't know what they would say if they could say. It's very difficult. I've made a film there, a documentary, and it's very difficult to get them talking. Yes, they don't like the Chinese occupation very much. But, of course, their version of Tibet and Tibet itself is very different from our version and is very different from China's version. And it's that Tibet, it seems to me, that as we engage in a kind of an archaeology, a discovery of it, bears further scrutiny. Well, I think I'll stop here, and I'd be happy to entertain any questions that you might have.
You have to stay there. Thank you, Orville Schell, Dean of UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism and author of Virtual Tibet, Searching for Shangri-La from the Himalayas to Hollywood. It was a most informative talk. Thank you very much. And now Greg Dalton, Vice Chair of the Program Committee of the Commonwealth Club, will conduct our question and answer session. Greg?
Thank you, Tony Rembe, President-elect of the Commonwealth Club, and our chair for this evening. We're speaking with Orville Schell, Dean of the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, and we have lots of questions, so let's begin. Some observers say that China will never deal with the present Dalai Lama, preferring to wait until the successor is installed. Could you comment on how China is dealing with the Tibetan leadership succession issue?
I'm afraid that China's strategy is presently, at least insofar as we can understand it, to wait until the Dalai Lama dies. He's now 64 years old. And, of course, that will set off a very tricky kind of a situation where his reincarnation will have to be found. And as we've learned from the search for the reincarnation of the Panchen Lama, the second highest reincarnate Lama in Tibet, the party finally canceled the young boy that the Dalai Lama approved and sanctioned a child of their approval. And one can only imagine what would happen if the Dalai Lama dies. It is, I think, in anticipation of this, of his death, that China is holding out very obdurately and refusing to negotiate in any way. Their unalterable demand, as it is in the case of Taiwan, is that the Dalai Lama and anyone they negotiate with say clearly and unambiguously that Tibet is a part of China and eschew all hopes of attaining any kind of independence in the future. The Dalai Lama is not advocating independence at this point. He is simply saying he thinks Tibet should have a high degree of autonomy, and he's willing to put the independence issue aside, but China won't talk to him. And thus, it's a real stalemate. I don't foresee any breakthrough, precisely because, in a way, China has painted itself into its own militant corner by its own propaganda of Tibet being unalterably a part of China, an internal affair, and thus will brook no compromise on this subject. And I think it's a great shame, very dangerous, because all that would happen that needs to happen is for the Dalai Lama to die and or for things to explode in Lhasa again. And then any chance of any kind of a peaceful revolution will be over for a long time to come.
At one point, the current Dalai Lama suggested that perhaps there shouldn't be any other Dalai Lamas. Is that still the case? Is it possible that there could be not be another Dalai Lama?
It's possible. I think his present view is that his reincarnation will be born outside of Tibet. And often high lamas who are reincarnated, this is a very elemental aspect of Tibetan Buddhism, they get to sort of designate where and sometimes how their reincarnation may be found. And by saying that, then the so-called search committee that would go out to look for him might find his reincarnation elsewhere.
How viable is the Free Tibet movement? Has American infatuation with Tibet, however misguided, improved the chances of preserving traditional Tibet?
Well, I think one has to ask oneself in this era of self-determination, you know, when Scotland is voting whether to secede from Great Britain and when Quebec gets to vote almost annually whether it will withdraw from the federal Canada, whether, you know, Tibet might not have the rights to some sort of a plebiscite as to its future. But having said that, I must say that even if the Chinese were to grant this, allow this to happen, it would be very, very difficult for Tibet to survive alone. And it's not what the Dalai Lama is asking for. Tibet is landlocked. It has no industry of its own save tourism. And I think whatever happens, it will be beholden to somebody and probably to China. And I think that the best option at this point would be for them to negotiate some sort of arrangement where it is culturally and to a large degree politically free, but foreign affairs and defense matters fall under the aegis of the Chinese government. The crucial question now is, will it survive as a culture? And of course, China is extremely afraid of Tibetan Buddhist culture because it is precisely around this culture, this religion, and these monasteries that nationalistic and independent sentiment arises. And this is exactly the sentiment that they wish to suppress in order to keep China part of what they call the motherland.
Historically, Tibet's political system has been a theocracy, and you mentioned some of the exploitative aspects of that. The U.S., on the other hand, tends to support and promote democracies overseas. Is the U.S. support for Tibet inconsistent with principles of the U.S.?
Well, the U.S. support for Tibet, such as it is, certainly doesn't run as far as advocating independence, perhaps some sort of autonomy. I don't think anybody realistically thinks that should the Dalai Lama ever go back, they will reinstitute the old theocratic system. Even he says that is not what he has in mind. That's gone. But what I think he hopes can be done is that by going back, he would be able to serve as the crystal around which monastic life could regenerate. Tibetan art, culture, ritual, and religion would have its leader back. And this very unique and distinctive civilization, which was badly damaged over the last few decades, might have a fighting chance to have some sort of recrudescence that would allow it to continue. Tibetans are very, very religious. They are incredibly devoted to the Dalai Lama and to Tibetan Buddhism. And I think it would be one of the great moments of this century if the Dalai Lama were to go back. And it's my own view that if the Chinese could see things clearly, they would understand that the Dalai Lama could be an extraordinary help in controlling the situation in Tibet, rather than a splittist and an agitator, which they fear. These things he may appear to them to be in the outside world. But if he were to go home, I think he is a person of sufficient honesty and integrity that he would limit himself to cultural matters and would also serve as a tremendously calming and reassuring presence, and indeed would end a period of Chinese history which has given them repeated black eyes. I can't think of any issue which gives China a worse reputation more regularly than Tibet, and you would think they would want to solve it. But alas, there are reasons why they can't and won't, because of internal Chinese politics and because, in a certain sense, the well has been poisoned for so many years in terms of the propaganda that has been launched that now the government itself runs into a problem of having to proselytize its people in a different direction if it wanted to solve the problem in some way that countermanded some of its earlier statements.
The Dalai Lama uses American advertising methods to create a strong sympathy for Tibet and name recognition for himself. Is there any possibility that the Dalai Lama has exploited this infatuation with Tibet that you've talked about?
Well, I think it's undeniable that the Dalai Lama, the word exploit is perhaps a bit excessive, but will use any means that he deems ethical to bring attention to the plight of his people and his country. That is undeniable. That he walks a fine line sometimes between becoming a kind of celebrity. Yes, I suppose this is a real problem. I think it's ever on his mind. After all, he is a contemplative religious figure. But I think he's very careful to try to maintain his own spiritual life intact. But very often when he's meeting celebrities and raising money and meeting members of Congress, I mean, he does, I think, feel he's a bit out of place. And indeed, one of the aspects that has always made the Dalai Lama so compelling and so interesting to us and indeed to Tibetans is his inaccessibility, his aloofness, his ineffability. And precisely by showing up on American television, he does, in a certain sense, make himself more mundane. And that, I think, he's aware of, too. But he is in a dilemma. If he keeps to his own self and closets himself in a monastery, he will, in a sense, I think, feel he is abandoning his people and not taking every opportunity he can to call attention to their plight. And I think that, along with his own religious practice, is the two primary objects of his present life.
Dean Schell, how do you maintain access to sources in China and Tibet while still telling the harsh and tragic truth about Chinese oppression in Tibet? Have you ever got into trouble with the Chinese government?
Well, truth, or at least what we imagine is truthfulness, often is indigestible to the Chinese Communist Party. And indeed, there are times in my long career in and around China when I have found myself somewhat indigestible. It's a tough situation, and China knows very well how to manipulate journalists, businessmen, academics, by threatening the denial of access. And it's a really tricky problem. You have to keep your wits about you, and you always have to remember to try to see things as clearly as you can. And I suppose there's really no other calling that a journalist should answer to except to try to be truthful and let the chips fall where they may on questions of access. Businessmen have another imperative, and that is they can't afford to run afoul of a government where they're doing business. So without being too indirect, I would simply say it's a constant high-wire act for any journalist who writes about China and tries to write truthfully.
How did Tibetan Buddhism come to be so trendy in a place like Hollywood, whose values of wealth and celebrity couldn't be further from the simple life suggested by Buddhism?
I think implicit within that question is the answer, that precisely because Hollywood is in its way, the zenith of striving, getting, deal-making, you know, one could go on, the people who find themselves wrapped up in that that vortex or swirling in that vortex feel desperately in need of some spiritual anchoring. And many of them are refugees from other faiths. And there is a bit of sort of spiritual supermarket shopping that does go on in the West. Hollywood is no more vulnerable to it than anyone else, and yet we hear about it because Hollywood celebrities and movie stars are so high profile. But some of them, I must say, I have found to be quite genuine in their searching and in their practice. You know, one might laugh at Richard Gere in some respects, but I think he is a person of enormous dedication and constancy, and for 20-odd years has been a practicing Buddhist. Finally, that's a very private thing, and But I wouldn't say it's all to be made light of. You know, one's spiritual life, one's religious life is a very private thing, and you get and find succor where you can find it. And it's really your business if you want to change religions.
Can a place like Tibet become just a little westernized, or is it like a rock pushed from the top of a hill?
Well, I mean, Tibet is a little westernized. But for those of us who are very westernized, we don't particularly like to see it become westernized. People are horrified when they arrive in Lhasa. It's subsequently changed its name, but to find a Holiday Inn. And yet I've got to tell you, I've sat and watched a lot of them. And they get up there at 12,000 feet and start having altitude sickness and desperate for an airbag and a good night's sleep. And they love that Holiday Inn. But it's a little bit, it mars the mythology to have that blinking sign there in the middle of Lhasa. So it's a very complicated relationship we have with this place. And yes, it is becoming westernized. China's westernized. And the world is westernized. And it's precisely because Tibet represented a place that wasn't westernized that we loved it and were infatuated with it. And now that it's changed, we are a bit more disenchanted with it. And the result is that we're all too willing to retreat into a movie about what it was like 50 years ago.
You mentioned the critical period of the Chinese invasion of Tibet and how the U.S. recreated Tibet in Hollywood. Could you say why the U.S. government didn't interact more rigorously when China marched into Tibet?
Well, Tibet had been so steadfastly isolationist until very late in the 40s when it realized that it was in trouble. when the Brits pulled out of India in 47, and it looked as if China was, in fact, the Chinese communists were going to win the Civil War. Then China began throwing lines out. Tibet began throwing lines out. Indeed, it made a plea to the United Nations to have its case considered as the Chinese People's Liberation Army began to march in. And I think it was El Salvador introduced the measure, and nobody wanted to hear about it. And it was a measure of China's, Tibet's inattention to forming international alliances before that, that nobody answered the call. And to this date, no power has recognized the independence of Tibet.
Perhaps it's appropriate that we end with a final question that is, in fact, an introspective question of Dean Shell to reflect upon your own infatuation with Tibet and why you didn't choose someplace else such as Texas.
Well, the short answer to that is I've been to Texas. I mean, I think my infatuation with Tibet, like many people's, was most redolent when it was unattained, before I'd been there. Having been there, I mean, I still have an affection for the place. It is an amazing place in its way. But, you know, it's there's nothing like actually waking up and finding yourself actually in the dream to spoil a dream. That's not to say that Tibet doesn't have its virtues. It's simply to say that perhaps we do best to dream about places that don't really exist and don't really matter. We seem to have an affinity of late to dream about outer space and to go to movies about outer space. I suspect, finally, that's a better place to launch our projections rather than a place that has a real problem, real people suffering that needs a real solution.
Our thanks to Orville Shell, Dean of the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism and the author of Virtual Tibet, Searching for Shangri-La from the Himalayas to Hollywood, for speaking today. We also thank our audience here in San Francisco and our listeners on the radio. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.